House Education Finance Committee will come to order. All right, we do have a number of bills we'd like to hear today, so we'll get right to it. But first, Representative Moran, would you like to move the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved.
All right. Any questions or comments on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Thank you for that. All right. Housekeeping is done. So we're pleased to have Chair Knobloch here with us, and I will go ahead and move that House File 4272 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with the Chair's intention today to lay it over for possible inclusion or further action at a later time. And welcome, Representative Knobloch.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 4272 is a bill that aims to reduce the special education cross-subsidy that exists in some of the highest cross-subsidy school districts in the state. The federal government, as you know, made a commitment to provide 40% of special education costs decades ago, but has never come close to even, I believe, meeting half of that commitment. The state spends a substantial amount on special education, and this amount is increasing fairly rapidly thanks to the automatic increases provided in statute for special education funding. Yet even with these increases, the cross-subsidy, the difference between the total special education costs in the state and the reimbursement to school districts for these costs, this cross-subsidy continues to grow. There is a great variation in the amount of cross-subsidy in different school districts in the state. Some districts have relatively small special education costs. But other districts, like St. Cloud District 742, have particularly high special education costs. This, in St. Cloud's case, is the result of its being a regional center to which many parents move when they have children with significant special education needs. St. Cloud has an unfunded cross-subsidy of over $1,500 per ADM student, which is $1,000 more per student than some other districts. In total, St. Cloud has an annual cross-subsidy of more than $11 million per year that needs to be made up from other resources. House File 4272 would allocate $20 million in fiscal year 19 to school districts across the state that have particularly high special education costs. It would reduce St. Cloud's cross subsidy by about 10%. I believe you should have in your packet a chart that shows how it affects other school districts. This bill is not a solution. Minnesota needs to figure out how to reduce the growth rate of special education costs while maintaining quality. I am hopeful that a working group being assembled to look at this issue will come up with some good ideas for this in the next session. But regardless, we do need to put additional funding into reducing the cross-subsidy, and this bill would help now some of those districts with the most significant cross-subsidy issues. And, Madam Chair, I have with me Bruce Henches, who is a board member of our school board in St. Cloud, District 742, that I'd like to have testify.
All right, very well. Nice to see you again, Mr. Henches.
And to see you, Chairwoman.
Please just introduce yourself for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Bruce Henches, a school board member in St. Cloud. And Madam Chair and distinguished committee members, I'm here today to representing the school board and administration of School District 742 to talk about the special education cross-subsidy from the perspective of the impact that it has on education in St. Cloud School District, and to ask your support for House File 4272 as introduced by Representative Knobloch. As you may know, St. Cloud has changed demographically over the recent years, with over 60% of our students now receiving free and reduced lunch, 20% receiving special education services, and 23% qualifying for English language learner services. Our district has changed. The special education cross-subsidy has reached a crisis point for many districts in Minnesota. The St. Cloud School District carries one of the highest per pupil cross subsidies in the state. In fact, during the 16-17 school year, only two districts carried a larger per pupil burden from the cross subsidy. The cross subsidy in St. Cloud for the current 17-18 school year is $11,659,000. That means that nearly $12 million is unavailable for programming for regular education students. The implications for education in our school district are significant. But you have all heard that, or have heard such stories from your school district constituents. We have written to legislators regarding the implications of the cross-subsidy to the educational program in St. Cloud. We have indicated a commitment to use 100% of any reduction in the cross-subsidy to provide educational programming for things like expanded summer school acceleration programs for underprivileged students, expanded programs to better meet the needs of our gifted and talented students, services for students with dyslexia, expanded early learning opportunities for underprivileged students, such as co-teaching, a program that we have begun with very positive results, increased career and technical education programs and advanced placement courses, and professional development to best meet the needs of all of our students. Our professional development program had to be reduced last year as we cut $4 million from our general fund budget, while we carried a cross-subsidy of $10 million. We would be grateful for any effort to close the special education cross-subsidy and allow us to better serve all of our students in the St. Cloud School District. We ask for your support of House File 4272, and we thank Representative Knobloch and Representative Tice for their support.
Thank you, Mr. Hinches. Any questions for Mr. Hinches or the author at this time? No, I think we'll just keep going with testimony. So, Mr. Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I'd like to give you a perspective, a statewide perspective, why we support this bill. If you look at this handout here with a couple graphs and charts, it might lend some perspective to the run you've been looking at. The cross-subsidy doesn't just exist out here like spinning in ether. You have to think of it in relationship to the formula. The cross-subsidy is actually the money from the formula that needs to go to the mandated services for children with IEPs. So if you take the formula minus the cross-subsidy, you end up with what we call the effective formula. The effective formula for the 85% of the children who do not have IEPs. If the cross-subsidy were the same for all students at $720 per pupil, it'd be an adequacy issue. It's just the formula would be just dropped that amount of money. But it's not. You've heard Representative Knobloch talk about the great variation. If you look at the table in the middle on the left there, you can see the size of that variation. It's 25% of the formula. You never intended the formula to have a 24% inequity when you do that work and that good work here at the Capitol. And actually, the smallest formula for both the metro and rural is one of our largest districts, Minneapolis, at 4413, and one of our smallest districts, Ivanhoe, at 82 students. So this young woman, pictured in today's paper, addressing some of the cuts in Minneapolis, in part is because they have the lowest effective formula in the metro area and one of the lowest in the state. So if you go to the bottom right-hand corner and you flip the formula, cross-subsidy in terms of the formula, and say, well, what really is the effective formula? The districts in darker have actually less than the average cross-subsidy for the region, therefore have a greater effective formula. And if you look at the gray boxes, those actually have a greater cross-subsidy, therefore even a less effective formula than the average, which is a little under, where the average is $5,000 in the metro and $5,232. Now let me talk a little bit about why we created these two regions. And Representative, I think one of our testifiers previously said that children, parents with medically fragile children and high needs children, move to places with medical facilities. And so in greater Minnesota, those are St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth. Those districts really look more like Minneapolis. And so we've created a regional where that's metro plus the greater Minnesota districts greater than 7,500 and the others. I also want to take a moment and thank Tom Melcher and Paul Farron at MDE for providing the technical assistance behind this with Tim Strong to be able to, you know, create these runs and create this new preliminary cross-subsidy formula that would create this revenue. So as you look at the runs, think about this. When I was in Boy Scouts, I was trained in first aid. And when you come across an accident, you do two things. You try to stop the bleeding and call for help. This is a stop the bleeding bill. We have recommendations for call for help. There's a study committee that's hopefully going to really work on calls for help. But if you're going to try to have an equity in the formula in 2019, you need to address the districts that have excessive cross-subsidies from 2017. There's a two-year lag in this. To be technical, I can go into that. So as you look at the run, if your district is in gray and is not receiving funds, that's actually a good thing. Your districts actually have a higher effective formula than the districts who are going to receive funding. Because the funding is only going to be 30% of the cross-subsidy up to a maximum of 120 students. So it doesn't even get them to where the districts in darker are in that lower in that graph on the front. So we urge you to support 4272 to bring equity for all kids with an effective formula or a little more equity. It's not a fix, but this will hopefully stop some of the cuts due to excessive cross-subsidies.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nolan. Did Scott Krinquist and Brad Lindell, I had you both down to testify. Why don't we go ahead and get all the testimony in that had signed up, and we'll go to questions then.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Scott Krinquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I want to add my thanks to Representative Knobloch for bringing this legislation forward. He has been a tireless worker in studying the special education issue and trying to find resolution and relief for school districts, so we greatly appreciate that, Representative Knobloch. As you all know, I mean, this is not a new issue. You know, the cross-subsidy is having just a tremendous impact on school district budgets across the state. And obviously, we'd like to see really for all districts, but we also understand that this is a supplemental budget year with limited resources. So we think it makes sense in that type of environment to look at the districts that are being hit the hardest and have really the most devastating special ed cross-subsidies. Our members, on average, have a $964 per pupil cross-subsidy, with nine districts having over $1,000 per pupil cross-subsidy. So this would obviously provide some real relief, and it would save jobs, you know, actually jobs, and have an impact on class sizes and just a whole range of services to students. This does not, you know, negate at all the need to have that special education task force that you're looking at, because we do need to continue to look at a long-term solution, but this would certainly provide some badly needed relief in the short term. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Krinquist. Mr. Lundell?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Brad Lundell is seeing. Thanks for putting that bench there, because it reminds me of my high school basketball career. I think I averaged a point and a half a game. I'm not sure of it. I'm here today on behalf of Schools for Equity Education and the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. I want to thank Representative Knobloch, Dr. Nolan, for working on this bill. Again, St. Cloud, I'm familiar with the situation there, and also familiar with the situation in many districts throughout the state. I think in echoing Mr. Krinquist's comments, I think that there's nothing here. I mean, this is very important. It's a discussion that needs to take place, and I think zeroing in on the districts that have the greatest problems right now is the appropriate way to go. I think in the long term, we need to look at ways that are going to get the cross-subsidy down, and again, that task force is going to be key in doing that. And again, we'll be participating in that task force, whether or not the Senator House position prevails. I know that we'll be at every meeting, and we'll be certainly weighing in on that. But again, thanks to Representative Knobloch. Thanks to the committee for hearing this bill, and certainly we want to support changes in the special ed. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. And is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill before we go to member questions? All right. Not seeing anybody come forward. We'll go ahead and move to member questions. Any questions for any of the testifiers or for the author? I just had one question, and maybe I'll direct it to nonpartisan or if either of you want to comment. But I think the chart was really helpful, and also the information sheet showing sort of the differences, and I think the explanation of regional centers and school districts and larger school districts in those centers perhaps attracting, as you said, parents with students with higher special needs. But do we know, Mr. Strom, if sort of the cross-subsidy and the averages, if that would look about the same over time, or if there have been significant changes in those numbers in recent years?
Madam Chair, I'll double-check with the cross-subsidy reports on the department's website, but it's my understanding that the averages for the different clusters, whether by size or county, have remained relatively the same over time. Some of the districts that have grown the most, like the St. Cloud School District, are certainly in a further away from the average than they were some years ago. But I can't think of any districts or groups of districts offhand where there's been a big change relative to the others. I'll double check.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And I didn't know if any of the testifiers wanted to comment, but just a question. I'm just wondering if we're seeing trends in that way. I know I have visited with some very small school districts where, again, a family with several children, all with special needs, that moves into a district can significantly change their landscape kind of overnight, but I would guess that's pretty rare. Representative Nubbett.
You know, I guess, Madam Chair, on one hand, I would say that, I mean, this has been an issue in St. Cloud that goes back even before we had a significant number of refugees start moving into the community, say, 15 years ago. I mean, this goes back a long time. But on the other hand, I think one of the things that has helped make it worse in recent years is as our demographics change in the community, I think just on average we have somewhat more kids in special ed, but then we have had a flattening or even a slight decrease in enrollment at a time when a higher percentage of our kids are becoming special ed. And so in terms of the total cross-subsidy gap, that is affecting us more than it used to.
Thank you. That's a good explanation. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if Mr. Strom could walk us through this spreadsheet. I'm finding this one a little more challenging than average.
Very good suggestion, and I missed that. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Strom, why don't you kind of give us the guide for how to look at this?
Madam Chair, members, the witnesses may want to jump in as well. Let me start by saying just a word about the cross-subsidy. For about 20 years now, the Department of Education has calculated the cross-subsidy, and the one that's usually used is something called the adjusted cross-subsidy. And what that does is it looks at the total spending on special education, removes from that the federal spending and the federal revenue, just calls that even. And so for purposes of this calculation, and then adds all of the spending for special education in the eligible categories, including the transportation together, that forms one half of the equation, the spending half. And then the revenue half is the state special education aid plus a portion of general education revenue that's essentially attributable to some of the kids that are in a placement that's for a substantial part of the day, assuming that their general ed revenue would follow them there. So the difference between the two is the middle column that you see on the spreadsheet called the unfunded cost of the cross-subsidy, and that's the amount essentially where there's no state aid attributable to the expenditures that the district's making on special education. So on the printout in front of you, as you look at the Atwater Cosmos Grove City School District, you'll see that for fiscal year 17 data, their expenditures on special education were $1.6 million. The reimbursement from the state through state aid was $750,000, which turns out to be a cross-subsidy of about $928 per pupil, that amount in the unfunded cost divided by the ADM served. The next category then shows the variance from the regional average. And as you look in that second column of data, you can see whether the districts in the rural or the metro region, their cross-subsidy is compared to that average. Atwater, Cosmos Grove City is $92 above the average, whereas the Academy for the Deaf in Faribault is $241 below the average. So that's the variance from the regional average. Then the essentially the if you jump then to the second to last column, then you'll see the effect of the third and second to last columns will show you essentially the effect of this bill, which is adding $20 million in special education aid and the amount that would go to each district based on their particular gap, their cross-subsidy gap. So the way the bill works is if you're above the regional average, then a portion of that, 30% of that gap is funded up to no more than $120 per pupil. And so if you've got a zero there, you don't have a gap compared to the regional average. If you've got a positive number in the second and third to last columns, those are the amounts of aid you'd be getting under this proposal.
Right, thank you, Mr. Stone. Mr. Nolan, did you want to
add one column is the 2017 effective formula, the fourth column in from the right. That is arrived at by taking 6067, which was the formula in 2017, minus the cross-subsidy per ADM. And it's kind of mixing and matching, I know, between APUs and ADMs, but that's a way to judge that, as to how much money is available in that district for the 85% of the students that are not student special ed.
All right. Thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair, then either Dr. Nolan or Mr. Strom, that last column is similar to the one that...
Yes, it would be the adjusted effective formula. You would add whatever aid was in the next to the one column in on the right to the effective formula.
Got it.
And then you get the new adjusted formula.
So that last column is the new happy day formula.
Yeah. It's to give an indication of what that would look like, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And maybe for Mr. Strom, is this proportional? So if 30% to get to the averages is $20 million, to get to 100% of those that gain the average, would that be roughly then times 3 or $60 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Markworth, yes, if you look up and down the printout, there's only a few districts that are affected by that $120 cap, so that portion wouldn't be proportional, but the rest is a straight measurement of that 30% gap. So three and a third times that is the statewide cost of funding that portion of the gap.
And so, Madam Chair, so that's just getting to the average. So what is the number, I should know, to completely do away with the cross-subsidy? Looking at, is it $1 billion a year? What are we looking at?
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about the long term here, and there's this task force. And I don't know what the task force, I mean, I think this is good, but ultimately, how big is our monetary problem? I don't know if someone might know that.
We'll pull that number up. Madam Chair, I'm so sorry. Representative Markworth, we'll pull that number up for you. It's in the $700 million range for the adjusted cross-subsidy, I believe, for 17 and growing at a fairly quick rate. But let me just pull that number right up for you here in a minute.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Clark. So, I mean, we have our work cut out for us yet, even with a task force that may come back and tell us to eliminate the... I mean, I don't know. I think this is a good way to at least... start equalizing things a little bit, but it doesn't, needless to say, get us to where we need to go ultimately. But thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Nolan?
Madam Chair, Representative Markworth and Committee, if you look at the front side of the sheet, on the left-hand side, there's a chart from Tom Melcher from January, and he updated that before the Ways and Means Committee just a couple weeks ago, and he said it was $751 million total cross-subsidy in 2017.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Representative Knobloch.
this is asking for $20 million for one time. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, it's asking for $20 million for this year.
And are you telling us that this will, could come out of the total amount of money that we have for the omnibus education finance bill?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we haven't set the targets for what they're going to be for the committees yet, and of course we don't know how we're all going to settle out in the final end here, but I brought this forward not with the view that this solves all our problems, to Representative Markworth's point, but to help illustrate that, you know, there are some districts that really have some inequities underneath the current system here because of their own individual circumstances. And, you know, as Ways and Means Chair, I have seen the cost of special education steadily growing up significantly faster than inflation, and this cost subsidy rising, even though we have in law a 4.6% increase in our special education reimbursement each year. And, you know, I've really struggled with this over the last 2 years. I do think that we need to put some more money into this to deal with the cross subject, but I also think there's an issue which is going to be addressed by the study group of trying to figure out ways to deliver special education services in a hopefully less costly way while preserving or perhaps increasing the quality. And so I think, you know, there's a two-part issue here. We do need to put some more money in here, but we also need to figure out ways to reduce the rate of growth that's happening in this area.
Representative Murphy.
And thank you, Representative Knobloch. And I hope it's a good omen for our whole priority list on this committee. But, and I haven't been able to study this, so I don't even know who the people that are bleeding or the districts that are hurt the most that you were referring to, that you say will be helped a little bit. And it seems to me we're just blocking a heart attack, so to speak, and trying to make the worst get a little bit better.
Yeah, and
in this. So, but could you address, well, the one thing I have is, out of these people, out of these people that are going to be, or the school districts that are going to be helped the most and need it the most. I'm not sure about need, but, and that's what I want to ask about. Could you address the fairness and the need of how much this additional money that a school district may receive is fairer or needier? Does need come in as part of the fairness?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, well, I think it does. I mean, basically the way the bill operates is it looks at what the average cross-subsidy gap per student is in different regions, and then for those districts that are above that average cross-subsidy gap, it allocates additional money. I mean, it doesn't obviously take care of all of the needs above the cross-subsidy average are far from it. Of course, it doesn't take care of anything below the average. There is obviously a huge cross-subsidy gap that would remain if we do this bill. But this is to try to take some of the edge off for the districts that are most affected. I would tell you that I think where we really need to go as a state and with this committee is I think we need to, A, as I mentioned, figure out some ways to deliver our special education services more efficiently, and then try to put over a number of years our state on sort of a glide path to eliminate the state cross-subsidy gap, the special education cross-subsidy gap. You know, it would be nice if the federal government would come forward and take care of their share of it, and I don't know that we should be trying to cover their share, but I would say that we should be, and it's not something that's going to be able to be done in a single biennium, but over some period of time we should try to and come up with some sort of plan that we would gradually phase out the state gap.
I can respond to that.
Mr. Nolan.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there's 340 children that would be positively affected by this in 128 school districts, 20 in the metro or metro region, and 108 in rural Minnesota. Those, we just did a survey. We have a number of districts making cuts. Minneapolis is making the front page of the paper. They have $33 million in cuts to make. We wouldn't want those cuts to be in due to excess cross-subsidy from 2 years ago, which would probably be carried forward into 19. They're probably budgeting for that. So while there is a two-year lag in this because it has to calculate the cross-subsidy before you know the averages and all that and know who has the greatest cross-subsidy, I know that the school boards and the administration and faculty and the parents would be very happy in some of these districts to know that they may not have to cut that amount of money in 19.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Superintendent Nolan, could you give me those figures? 340 children.
Yep, it's on the
128 school districts.
It's on the front page of this. It's on the back page of this at the bottom. You can just find this and circle it. 340,000, actually, it's 340,000 students in 128 districts. And the other, I think one of the nice features of this is if you look at the average effect in the two regions, it's very similar. So there's equity between the regions in the average amount of money per pupil to address these excessive cross subsidies. And again, I want to thank Tom Melcher for a lot of the technical help here in putting this together.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions for any of the testifiers or nonpartisan staff? All right. Not seeing any. Representative Knobloch, any final comments?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for hearing this very important bill. This is a important issue before our state. It's a vexing problem. It's not going to be solved overnight or in one biennium, but I appreciate members' consideration of this and looking at it because it is a problem that we need to deal with. This is obviously sort of a one-time kind of temporary issue to take the edge off, but I hope that it has helped enlighten people some more about the extent of the problem, and I appreciate your consideration.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Knobloch. And I appreciate all your hard work on this. It's a very complex area, and to try to delve in and come up with something is not easy. So I appreciate your work on this. And so,
well, thank you. And I appreciate Mr. Nolan and Mr. Melcher and Mr. Strom and Mr. Henches and the others that have worked with me on it, too.
All right. Thank you very much. And pursuant to my previous announcement, I'm laying this over for today. But thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Detmer, you ready? And while he is coming forward, I will go ahead and move that House File 3591 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. But today I'm going to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. And thank you very much for being here, Representative Detmer. I have a feeling we have maybe talked about this topic once or twice before.
Well, probably, Madam Chair, probably 100 times. But I want to thank you for allowing me to come in and present this to the Education Committee. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting House File 3591. It's similar to the bill that I authored last year. And I want to thank the committee for, if you could take a look at the summary of the bill, I want to thank the committee for the help last year in starting to address an issue that doesn't just affect my district, but I represent. And as many of you know, I taught for 34 years at Forest Lake High School. But transportation costs can be a huge burden on many districts. In fact, there's roughly 65 districts around the state that have deficits in their transportation costs. And I would advise committee members to check with your districts, your local districts, in fact, all members to check with their districts to see if they fall into that 65 number. With me today, I have Mr. Steve Massey, our superintendent for Forest Lake Area Schools, where I taught, as I mentioned, and to give you a brief testimony to help you understand and what's really going on with this transportation sparsity problem that we have in our state. And he will answer any questions that the committee might have. Mr. Massey.
All right, welcome.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Representative Detmer indicated, my name is Steve Mass. I'm superintendent for Forest Lake Area Schools. And thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of House File 3591, which will increase transportation funding for school districts that run a large annual deficit due to heightened transportation costs. I first want to extend our heartfelt thanks to the members of this committee and the legislature for helping us pass a bill last year to secure partial funding to address this issue. Every year, our school district faces about $1 million deficit before we even begin budgeting our budgeting process for the school year. This deficit is due to the high cost involved in transporting students over an area, in our case, of more than 215 square miles. We are forced to cover the shortfall from our general fund using dollars that could go toward enhancing school security, staff, books, new technologies, and other learning tools to improve the learning experience for students. Because of the bill you passed last year, we currently receive an additional $85,000, or about 8.5% of our transportation deficit. Again, we thank you for that assistance. We are here today, however, to ask that you please consider an increase to that amount. As we prepare for the 2018-19 school year, we face a $2 million deficit in part because of our transportation deficit. Last Thursday evening, our school board approved a $1.7 million budget reduction, and they will be presented with a recommendation for another $300,000 reduction at their next school board meeting. We have scheduled a public hearing, in fact, for the purpose of considering the closing of Central Montessori Elementary School, one of our elementary schools, a wonderful school that has been part of our families and our district for over 30 years. The closing of a school is always a painful process, and we are sad that our financial crisis has led us to this point. Other programs that help make our district a special place for kids, including our outstanding music program, are at risk of budget cuts due to revenue shortfalls. If the legislature could appropriate funding to eliminate the $1 million deficit in transportation we face this year, cuts like these might be averted. Again, thank you for your help last year in creating a means by which districts like ours and other districts across the state that face a similar transportation deficit can offset these extreme costs. It is my hope that moving forward we can finally level the playing field and allow districts to spend more of their general education revenue funds closer to the classroom. And our business manager, Larry Martini, and I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Massey. Appreciate you being here. Is Mr. Martini just for questions, or is he wanting to testify? Okay, as a resource.
He's on the bench.
All right. Feel free to sit at the table if you would like, Mr. Martini. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Mr. Lundell, come on down.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell. I should have just stayed on the bench. I'm here on behalf of both schools for equity and education and the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation. Happy again to testify in favor of Representative Detmer's ongoing quest to fix the transportation funding formula. I think that you'll get into it's not just these problems aren't just isolated to one area of the state, but I do see that in a lot of the outer ring suburbs where you've had new housing developments that are far away from school buildings, and then you also have the hazardous transportation, the major highways that run, you know, separate these housing developments from schools, that I think you do have some challenges with the transportation formula that need to be looked at more closely. Again, I want to support Representative Detmer and his efforts here and certainly understand the issues in Forest Lake and in a number of other districts in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. All right, is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? All right, any questions from members? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair,
Representative Detmer, Superintendent, I understand what you're saying, and I understand rural transportation issues as well as metropolitan transportation issues because you taught us so well last year when you appeared during the appropriation year, and I appreciated that very much, and I was happy to support additional transportation funding. But this is a supplemental year, and in House File 3591, I don't detect the urgency that exists. We funded what we could last year for the biennium, and I understand the 8%, and you only got 8%, and that wasn't what you were at, the full thing that you needed. But could you explain a little more about the urgency of House File, that emergency, urgent? School districts have an urgency that need the supplemental money in this budget year.
Madam Chair,
members
of the committee, I can certainly speak to the urgency and foresight. As I indicated in my opening statement, we start our year close to $1 million in the hole before we start because of our transportation deficit. There are districts that don't face the deficit that we do that start the year without the deficit. And that is a matter of dire need in our case. So to speak to the urgency of the cuts that we face, the challenges meeting the educational needs of our students in our district, when we start in the hole before we start to cover our transportation deficit, it's a real challenge for us.
Representative
Murphy, if you take a look at the bill, you notice that I don't have an amount in there. I'm going to leave that amount up to the committee and the chair to see if we can take the next step and start to eliminate this transportation sparsity problem that we have here in the state. And I mentioned there's 65 plus districts that have this issue. And there are some districts that are actually making money on their transportation because the students are very close in to the school, whereas Forest Lake, Bemidji, Anoka, different school districts like yours, they're very spread out. So it's the number of miles you put on just isn't covered by the per-pupil funding for transportation. So it is a real issue for those districts that are having this issue. And I know with Forest Lake it is. You're looking at $1 million a year or $2 million a biennium. It's a real issue for school districts like Forest Lake. I think Bemidji has around 800,000. Anoka has about 600,000. So it's across the board.
Other questions? All right, not seeing any. Representative Detmer, you want to wrap this up?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members, I hope we are able to find additional resources. I know, as Representative Murphy pointed out, it could be tough, but we really want to hit home what this issue is about with transportation, to help districts like Forest Lake to continue to work towards a solution to this problem that we have as a state. And I would ask that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much. And the bill is laid over, and I appreciate you very much. You've been a very good advocate for your school district, and thank you for bringing your superintendent and the business manager today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Representative Jessup, you're ready to go? And so, Representative Jessup, I will move that House File 4302 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. But today, we're going to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or further action at a later time. And welcome to the Education Finance Committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to present before you today. This is an appropriations bill that we would be looking at for up to $250,000. The amount that we are looking for is to cover the education scholarships we'll talk about, or education funding for teachers who are in the secondary schools, mainly our high schools, that would be taking courses for post-secondary credit. So these would be above and beyond what they need to do now. The reason that we are asking for this money is that we have a program, concurrent enrollment, which I'd like to speak to a little bit, and then I'm going to have, I have two testifiers here from the Mounds View School District that will talk more so about specifically what is occurring in their district. But I want to start in general, if I can, back one step. Last year, I recall being a freshman representative, hearing about Minnesota, and typically our rankings were always ranked, you know, 1, 2, 3, or 4, and it's always on a good note. Well, on this particular occasion, we had a ranking that came out last year, and we were number 4. It was not a very good ranking because it was a ranking of those states with graduates that had the highest level of debt once they graduated. That's not where we want to be, and I think I can speak for all of us here that would say that we would like to see those that graduate from post-secondary education to have a lower amount of debt than what we are observing today. And we do everything we can in terms of providing financial assistance through the state grant program, also to our public universities, to really pull down that amount of debt that these graduates have. Some have proposed, you know what, we should just go ahead and pay, the state should just pay for 2 free years of college education or post-secondary education for every student that comes out. That would be a very expensive proposition. What I would say is we've got an emerging opportunity here, and that is called concurrent enrollment. And there have been initiatives that have already been in place before my time serving with you here. But this concurrent enrollment really gives the opportunity for students in high school to go ahead and take classes that not only provide them high school credit, but also college or post-secondary credit. And I think that's an excellent model for us to continue to pursue. And I know that we've had some initiatives, and I want to say, Representative Nornes, you kind of led some of the effort earlier with the Northwest Regional Partnership. The school district of Mounds View has been doing this as well. And I would like to have them tell you a little bit about their program, the success that they have had, and how they are expanding that program and where the need is. With me today is Dr. Jeff Riddlehuber. He's the assistant superintendent for the school district, as well as Michael Werner. He is the dean of post-secondary services. And I'd like you to hear from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. And welcome. And please just introduce yourselves before you provide your testimony.
Yes. Madam Chair, my name is Jeff Riddlehuber, and I serve as Mounds View Public Schools Assistant Superintendent. I'd like to sincerely thank Representative Jessup for carrying House File 4302 and also the House Education Finance Committee for hearing this testimony this afternoon. I'd like to begin by expressing the regrets of Mounds View Public Schools Superintendent Chris Lennox for not being available today. Our district's hosting a national speaker on the topic of culture-responsive teaching in the brain, and this agreement was planned several months ago, so he does want to address those regrets. In terms of testimony, the need for the bill begins and ends with the innovative and creative approach to education that is needed in our public schools. 5 years ago, Mounds View embarked on a robust plan to recreate the entire K-12 experience via concurrent enrollment. This plan has not only been tremendously successful on all accounts, it has evolved and expanded to include industry-needed pathways in several of our most necessary trades. Currently, 97% of our high school students participate in concurrent enrollment, and the continuation of this program is vital to the needs of our students and our families. Regardless of a student's chosen field of study, concurrent enrollment has played a significant role within our district. With the Higher Learning Commission decision to now require our high school teachers to attain additional credentialing by the fall of 2022, funds necessary to assist our teachers in attaining these credentials is needed to help in this endeavor. This funding is most certainly a bipartisan request, and from a financial standpoint, it's also a wise investment for the state of Minnesota. For example, The Moundsview Public Schools class of 2017, which is Irondale and Moundsview High Schools, saved an estimated $4.4 million in tuition costs prior to even setting foot on a post-secondary school campus. This not only saves our students and families money, but it saves the state of Minnesota that these funds would certainly be used to partially cover state tuition costs that can be saved in other areas. A conservative annual estimate of savings would be in excess of $1 million. At this point, I'd like to pass the baton to Mr. Michael Werner, as he's been instrumental in developing these programs, and he can share a few thoughts on a few other items associated with this.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to us today. Since its inception in 2012 at Irondale High School and 2013 at Moundsview High School, the earliest college program at Moundsview Public Schools has garnered national attention. Then-Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan visited Irondale High School to learn more about our program and to underscore the importance of identifying pathways and models in which students, primarily those who are maybe first-generation or underserved populations, can earn college credit while in high school, thus lessening their time at a post-secondary institution and reducing their debt load. Most recently, we've been recognized and chosen by Jobs for the Future, a national nonprofit organization committed to equity in all and economic and educational access for all populations to serve as a model for which they're looking at our current concurrent enrollment program and the programs we have in place to make sure our teachers in these programs can and will meet the HLC credentialing requirement of 2022. In our work with Jobs for the Future, we have created gap analyses. We have created vast employment opportunities that look at whether or not teachers who are credentialed will retire and what that looks like for our course offerings, as well as creating specific pathways for teachers to go out and identify ways to take advantage of the funding that the state has already provided through the 18 online program, as well as the last year's funding to Metro Exu in order to participate in those programs. That work is then going to be shared nationally through our work with Jobs for the Future as a model for not only those in the state of Minnesota, but at other states who are struggling to meet the credentialing requirements of the HLC. Most recently, Moundsview continues to be innovative after listening to a variety of students and families who are asking how and where do we meet the needs of local employers who continue to meet with us and ask how can we help them provide high-wage, livable wage jobs to those students who may not immediately want to pursue a two-year or four-year degree program. Recently, we unrolled and unveiled the Pathways to Possibilities programs in Moundsview Public Schools. I believe this handout is amongst your documents. You will find in here not only the traditional AA pathway, the Associate of Arts degree pathway, but a variety of different pathways surrounding a variety of different interest areas, everything from automotive to engineering and manufacturing. In these different pathways, we have incorporated the concurrent enrollment coursework that students are already taking as part of the AA pathway to make sure that they fit either in job skill development and or in methods and ways that they would then match into a 2 or 4 year degree program. I would like to draw your attention to the construction and solar technology program in that we believe we are one of the first in the state of Minnesota to offer a solar technology program partnering with Century College, which we also believe is one of the only two-year colleges to offer a solar technology program. In this, we are hoping to build and design a program where students will learn the technical aspects of solar power, but also the applicable aspects of what it may look like to be employed in that field, with the ultimate goal of creating and constructing solar-powered ice houses, which we will then display and hopefully find a market for, since ice fishing is fairly popular in the state. And so that is one more unique and innovative way that we are doing this. We are very appreciative to Representative Jessup and all of you here today for listening to House File 4302 and taking the time to learn a little bit more about Moundsview Public School and public schools and its innovative approach to concurrent enrollment.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Very interesting testimony. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on House File 3591? All right. Then we'll go ahead and move to member questions. Representative Peterson. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation and showing all the different options you have for your school district. They're wonderful. I was just curious, what's your most popular college credit course?
I'm sorry. Rydell Hoover, am I getting that right?
Correct. You can guess.
That's a really good question. I think they're still in the areas, Madam Chair and Representative Peterson. I think most often it's in the areas of mathematics and also in English language.
Okay. Representative Sandstead. Thank you, Madam Chair. For our last testifier, your Pathways to Possibilities program, is that similar to like the academies, but maybe with the option of some college credit? Mr. Werner.
Madam Chair, yes, you are correct. We modeled these after some of the different career academies in the state and took a look at those and then built we already have as far as concurrent enrollment courses that meet the needs of 2- and 4-year programs into those so that students, if they choose to, can pursue college credit while participating in some of these different pathways.
Thank you, Representative Stinson. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation and bringing this forward for us to discuss. I have a few questions on how it would work, and I'm looking through the documents here, and it doesn't seem clear to me how many teachers the 250,000 would impact and how much each teacher would be able to get. And then I have a third question that's a little unrelated.
Okay. Mr. Werner?
Madam Chair, Representative. Currently we have approximately 36 teachers who are in one way or another moving through, they're attaining their required 18 graduate level credits to meet the HLC credentialing. And so I cannot give you a straight number that will fit for each individual teacher. However, we have some who need no more than 2 credits because of the move from 16 required to 18, and we have others that we've identified as being in the pipeline given our work with the gap analyses and others and factoring in upcoming retirements prior to the 2022 deadline.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. That's helpful to know how many teachers this would impact, and it sounds like it depends on where they're at. They might need just a little bit of help or more. This gives that flexibility. My third question was more on a broader scale, and maybe it's for Mr. Strom. Do we know how many other school districts are having the same situation? Because this is just Moundsview, and we have a lot of other school districts that might be running into the same problem. Do we have any data on that?
I will turn to Mr. Strom, and I know we have the Northwest, the partnership that was created, and in online classes were created for teachers to access through that mechanism. But I don't know if we've got a count. Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, we'll check for you, Representative Wills. As Representative Loon said, the Northwest Area Partnership that was created in 2016 and then broadened to statewide last year was set up for this reason on a state basis, and I think there's been a fair amount of data collection about the number of teachers that need credits, but we'll double check on those numbers for you.
Representative Wells.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Strom. I think that information would be helpful. I know that these programs are very valuable in making sure the students are prepared for college and get the opportunity to get their college credits and having the teachers prepared so they can meet the new requirements is a burden, and so we want to help them any way we can. So I appreciate this bill and anything we can do for the rest of the state. So thank you.
Yeah. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, Dr. Riddle-Hoover, good to see you. I hadn't realized you'd moved up to Assistant Superintendent. Congratulations. It's a credit to Moundsview that they're holding on to this guy. I think Representative Wills and I might be working the same area. I'm not understanding, given that the Northwest piece went statewide last year, why the need for this in Moundsview. And I'm looking over there, but they're shaking their heads real hard and fast. And why not everybody, or why help?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney, that's a really good question and one that we anticipated that would be asked by the committee. We, as the largest concurrent enrollment program in the state with what we feel are probably the largest number of teachers, we do feel we're drawing disproportionately from the limited state funds that are available through the 18 online program, through the Northwest Partnership, as well as the limited funds that are available through Metro Exu. And given that we have the largest population and we have approximately 12 teachers who are already taking advantage of the funds available through 18 Online and Metro FSU, and we predict another 15 or so will begin classes again in the summer of 2018, that we feel obviously very grateful for Representative Jessup for coming up with this idea, as well as all of you for hearing it. But we do express some concern for the other school districts that have far smaller populations and may need these far more than we do currently at the time.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so you're probably good at math. If I recall correctly, the state funds concurrent enrollment at about 30% of the statutory rate. So the statutory rate, if I remember correctly, is about $120, and we're plugging in, right, plus or minus $40, plus or minus a few bucks. If we fully funded our commitment to support concurrent enrollment programs, could you guys do without this special allotment for just Moundsview and make it work out of your own revenues then?
I don't know, was it Mr. Warner or Mr. Redenberg?
They're the one.
Madam Chair, Representative Denny, I'm not sure I would be able to answer that question today. What I can say is that currently we have been making every attempt to utilize every resource that's available, including from our own general fund dollars. They're not going to be enough to keep this afloat in the manner in which our students and families deserve right now without some additional funding. Along with the retirements that are likely to be on the horizon, we need to start building our bench. When you have one or two teachers here that we need to get credentialed, we can handle that as a school district. However, when we're sitting at 36, it's quite a burden at this point in time. And so the funds would be very useful, very well used to get us at a point where we are self-sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any. Representative Jessup, want to wrap us up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mentioned very on, I was kind of giving a global perspective of where we are in terms of graduates graduating with a significant amount of debt. And I look at this opportunity and I say, you know, I really applaud the school district because they're not only looking at an AA degree potential for students, but now they are looking at other fields of study as well and incorporating those into the high school experience. And I think really that is a model that I would like to see, and I anticipate some of you would also like to see for other school districts around the state. If we think about it, and if we were able to take this particular model, again, we want to see continued success on what Moundsview is doing, but if we were able to take this model forward and expand it based upon their experience and upon their results and expand that out to other schools, I think, in the state, I think that would put us ahead and really a pioneer in terms of education for our students and also for, I think, the families that they come from. If our graduates were able to knock, instead of $32,000 of average debt for a student that has debt graduating, and that went down to more like $15,000, that'd be a significant result and something I think that we could all aspire to achieve. If we did that, I think that would be beneficial overall for the graduates themselves, for the families, and also I would say for the Minnesota economy. So I'm looking at this and I'm saying, if we can deliver success with this particular school district, which has already got a great track record ahead, I think it could serve for us in terms of modeling for other school districts as we move forward and try and pull down the debt load of our graduates. With that, Madam Chair, I thank you for the opportunity to be here. Committee, I appreciate your consideration.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Jessup, and to your testifiers, thank you very much. Interesting program, and we all learned a lot about it today. I appreciate that. So, with that, we're laying the bill over for today. Thanks so much for presenting. And we are now to Representative Frankie. All right. Well, then, Representative Franke, I will go ahead and move that House File 4299 be sent to the General Register with the intention today of laying it over for possible inclusion of further action at a later time. And welcome to the Education Finance Committee.
Thank you, Chair Lewin. Thank you, members, for your time today. And House File 4299, this bill will require school boards to establish threat assessment teams and a committee to oversee those threat assessment teams. You know, we've had some of these discussions already in ed policy. We've made a few changes to the bill. I'm just going to cut my comments short at this point and jump right to my testifiers. They're very well versed in this area, and I would like to introduce you to all of them and let you listen to their expertise. To my right now, I have Sergeant Randy McAllister of Cottage Grove Police Department. He is also a threat assessment specialist. And Sergeant McAllister, I would like to say, has recently received some good news. He will soon be Captain McAllister. So how about a little round of applause?
All right.
So right now I will turn the mic over to him.
Thank you. Very good. Should we call you by your new title yet, or is it not quite official?
Not quite yet.
Okay, all right. We don't want to jinx anything. All right, so. So, Sergeant McAllister, welcome. Please just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Randy McAllister. I've been with the Cottage Grove Police Department now for 20 years as of 3 weeks ago. I currently supervise my department's investigation bureau, and probably more importantly, I've been a member of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals now for 8 years because I'd much rather prevent violence than respond to it. I'm also one of the first 24 people in the country to become a certified threat manager through the association. We're obviously here today in response to the tragic school shooting in Florida on this past Valentine's Day, and because we have realized that we need to do a better job of protecting our children from these kinds of events. In 2015, the Federal Bureau of Investigations held a symposium and brought together academic researchers, mental health experts, and law enforcement experts to discuss the active shooter phenomenon with specific focus on prevention strategies. By far, the most valuable prevention strategy identified was the threat assessment and management team. The findings of the symposium were published under the title Making Prevention a Reality, and that's available as a free download on the FBI's website. So what is threat assessment management? It is the process or method of identifying, assessing, and managing the risk of future planned violence. It is evidence-based and has become widely accepted as a gold standard and standard of care for targeted violence prevention. In fact, in 2013, the American Psychological Association, in a white paper addressing gun violence in the U.S., noted that the behavioral threat assessment is an emerging best practice. It is not punitive in nature, nor is it profiling. Actually, it's the opposite of profiling, because it looks at observable behaviors identified through years of research and other risk factors to help the assessor identify persons at higher risk for violence or moving towards a violent act in order to deflect them away from that pathway to violence. Threat assessment as a discipline has been around for at least 20 years, yet I would say most criminal justice systems and school districts in the U.S. have failed to adopt threat assessment and management as a formal day-to-day strategy for preventing violence. After the Columbine shooting in 1999, the U.S. Secret Service and the U.S. Department of Education looked at 26 years of data on school shootings in America. Their study was published in 2002 as the final report and findings of the Safe School Initiative. Since this landmark study, a multitude of other researchers have also looked at targeted violence in schools and discovered that targeted violence is a process. It's carried out over time with unique warning behaviors. The Safe School study and multiple other experts have recommended K through 12 behavioral threat assessment teams and programs as a best practice and standard of care to prevent the kind of school shootings we saw in Columbine and more recently in Florida. I would also add that 95% of these school shooters or school attackers in the study were in fact current students, so they had easy access to the school. In other words, it was normal for them to be there. They would typically go unchallenged, etc. In these situations, adding expensive physical security measures such as cameras and locked doors is going to do very little to stop the attacks. Columbine certainly proved this, as have many other such incidents since then. So the authors concluded, again, as far back as 2002, that many of these attacks may have been preventable, and the best tool for preventing these sorts of attacks are trained threat assessment teams and formalized processes. So fast forward to Virginia Tech. The mass shooting at Virginia Tech in 2007 resulted in a top-down assessment of violence prevention at Virginia Tech and concluded, similarly, in a report to the Virginia governor, that the incident should have been preventable because multiple people at Virginia Tech in multiple specialties and positions recognized red flag behaviors. Also, what they lacked was a system that could help them connect the dots and assess for violence risk. Also, there were unreasonable fears and misunderstandings of federal laws such as FERPA and HIPAA that led to people not sharing information even when they were allowed to do so under these laws. Essentially, each part of the university operating in its own silo of information. It has been said in order to connect the dots, you have to collect the dots. A formal and robust multidisciplinary threat assessment system helps you do this better, be it in higher education or K-12. Recently, Dr. Lena Alathari, chief of the United States Secret Service's National Threat Assessment Center, testified before the United States Senate Committee on Judiciary. In testifying on behalf of behavioral threat assessment programs, she noted, and I quote, "They not only have the potential of preventing incidents of targeted violence, but they have other positive impacts in the school environment. According to research conducted by Dr. Dewey Cornell at the University of Virginia, schools with threat assessment programs also had lower rates of suspensions and expulsions, decreased incidents of bullying, increased reporting from students when they were concerned about a classmate, and climates where just generally students felt more safe." Unquote. Additionally, Dr. Cornell has found that threat assessment programs did not produce racial disparities in disciplinary sanctions, which is not necessarily true with schools that do not have trained threat assessment teams. There are school districts in Minnesota which have threat assessment policies and teams. However, in my experience and through informal conversations, I believe that many times these teams are not formally trained. They tend to be ad hoc in nature, and they do not necessarily follow the guidelines put forth by the U.S. Department of Education and others. House File 4299 would require all Minnesota school districts to establish multidisciplinary teams in their districts and require the participation of counseling, mental health, school administration, and law enforcement. And again, this is in accordance with accepted best practices. Ideally, HF 4299, if passed, should be accompanied by funding to contract for development of model policies, procedures, and guidelines, and to pay for statewide training so that school districts have a clear map for implementing successful threat assessment programs that are consistent with best practices and are evidence-based. Among all the school safety-related bills and proposals this year, behavioral threat assessment is by far the most cost-effective and the best evidence-supported way to prevent a Columbine or a Parkland, Florida-type attack. And just as an aside, in doing some research on this, Virginia was the first state, I believe, to institute a requirement for a K-12 threat assessment. They're a larger state in terms of population, and they were able to fully implement a threat assessment program at the K-12 level for $700,000 over 3 years. So that's on average $233,000 spent every year, if my math is correct. And so it's very cost-effective. And again, they were able to train every school district in the state for that amount. With that, I thank you very much for your time and attention to this important bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Sergeant McAllister. Great testimony. We appreciate that. I think why don't we go ahead and hear from other testifiers, and then we'll go to questions. All right, and please just state your name and who you're with for the record, and we welcome your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Erickson, it's good to see you again. My name is John Giebel. I was a former police officer for the city of St. Louis Park for 10 years, three of those years as a sergeant. I spent part of my time as a police officer, as a DARE officer, and school liaison officer, and for the record, that was probably my favorite position that I held there. So I want to thank you for allowing us to testify this morning. My goal is to provide a high-level overview on how threat assessment works in a corporate setting. Keep in mind that the basic concepts that I'm going to walk you through defines how it works in a corporate setting, and modifications will need to be made for it to be implemented in a school setting as well. For the last 15 years, I've worked for Target Corporation and Boston Scientific as a global workplace violence and threat assessment manager. It was in these positions where I built a threat assessment team and a workplace violence program for the ground up at both companies. I've experienced a lot over the last 25 years and have seen firsthand the devastation inflicted by humans. The lifelong psychological damage that comes with each of these situations does not just impact the victim, it's very far-reaching. You and I are no different. We're passionate about education, and we care about the students and staff within our schools, and we want to make change so that our children can learn in an environment that is safe and feels safe. So I'm here today because together I think we can accomplish that. A threat assessment team is a proactive approach to addressing the issues of violence, typically as a response to an actual or perceived threat or concerning behavior. The primary purpose of a threat assessment team is to prevent targeted violence. The threat assessment process is centered upon an analysis of the facts and evidence of behavior in a given situation. The appraisal of risk in a threat assessment focuses on actions, communications, and specific circumstances that might suggest that an individual intends to mount an attack and is engaged in planning or preparing for that attack. In a situation that becomes the focus of a threat assessment inquiry or investigation, the appropriate team members gather information, evaluate facts, and make a determination as to whether a given individual poses a threat of violence. If an inquiry indicates that there is a risk of violence in a specific situation, team members conducting the threat assessment collaborate with others to develop and implement a plan to manage or reduce that threat posed by that individual in that situation. The threat assessment team's approach is holistic. It addresses the threatening situation first to stop the threat, but then it works backwards to address the root cause of the issue so it doesn't repeat itself. In the end, after preventing an incident, the victim and or troubled individual both receive the proper resources to help recover, heal, and grow in parallel with accountability measures. A threat assessment team can be defined in two ways, but simply put, a threat assessment team is a violence prevention strategy that involves, one, identifying threats to commit a violent act, two, determining the seriousness of a threat, and three, developing intervention plans that protect potential victims. The creation of a formal multidisciplinary threat assessment team is one of an organization and a school's most valuable resource in helping to address a wide variety of threats. It creates consistency through policies and best practices and accountability that all situations are dealt with appropriately by a highly trained team. A threat assessment is not punitive. It does not profile individuals, and it doesn't label individuals. What a threat assessment team is it's fair, it's objective, it's factual-based, and it's collaborative. In a school setting, a threat assessment team is not going to be much different than it would be in a business setting. The goals of threat assessment are to keep businesses and schools safe and to help potential offenders overcome the underlying sources of their anger, hopelessness, or despair. Often, the active shooter epidemic we're facing in America will overshadow the many areas of a typical threat assessment team and what they focus on. A comprehensive threat assessment team will focus on many aspects of violence, including the active shooter, of course, assault, bullying and harassment, domestic violence, stalking, and threats of self-harm and suicide. Threat assessment teams in general are comprised of the following roles. There's a process guardian that has overall oversight. There's a threat assessment team leader, and there's members of security, employee relations, human resources, and legal. There are also subject matter experts that we seek counsel from in areas of domestic violence, stalking, threats of self-harm and suicide, and then operational and clinical psychologists. So how a threat is processed, this is typically what it looks like. The threat assessment team leader is made aware of a threat and gathers initial information to assess the seriousness of the threat. If a threat's determined to be high risk, the team leader immediately contacts the threat assessment team for a meeting. After the initial meeting, there's typically additional information that's required for the assessment. That can include background information, social media activity is reviewed, we look at disciplinary records and annual reviews. We try to learn as much as we can about home life, so what kind of stressors or triggers are occurring at home. is there known or suspected mental health issues we need to take into consideration? And we also interview many people who may know this individual so that we can better understand the situation as a whole. The threat management team then regroups and goes over the new information and a series of mitigation actions are then put into place. A review of the mitigation efforts occurs shortly after implementation to measure the impact. If the efforts are working, we'll continue with the plan. If not, we'll start again. Other roles of a threat management team include they're responsible for the education and training of all employees. There's a steering committee that's created, and that provides accountability, oversight, leadership, and guidance. There are annual and quarterly metrics that are reviewed, so if we see trending that occurs, we can address that immediately. There's lessons learned that are shared after each incident, and we share that with other corporations and threat managers, so we're always learning. And then there's a comprehensive resource site that's created for the use of the threat assessment team, and in our case, our HR and ER team. I'm going to walk you through real quick an example of how it's worked. An employee reported that another employee had made some disturbing comments to her. The comments he made pertained to shooting this employee and her entire family and skinning her baby alive in front of her. The subject was also accusing this employee of trying to talk him into bringing a gun to work and shoot employees and then shoot the cops when they respond. It was reported that he had recently withdrawn from others at work and his personality had changed drastically. When I interviewed the subject, it was very clear that he posed a significant threat. He confirmed the statements made, he claimed to hear voices, and he said his coworkers trying to get him to react violently. I learned that he owned an AR-15 and other guns, and he practiced shooting on a regular basis. He was recently turned down for promotion at work. An additional change at work caused him to build resentment against the company and his coworkers. For this situation, because of its severity, I did reach out to a subject matter expert who is a forensic psychologist, and she conducted a forensic psychological evaluation. She diagnosed the subject as being psychotic, paranoid, and delusional, and stated that there was a very high risk of a workplace violence incident occurring. So that's just one example of situations that come before our threat assessment team. In closing, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on this important subject. Change begins with courageous and influential leadership, leaders who can exhibit the courage to make bold decisions when faced with tough choices and tough challenges. It requires the ability to talk through uncomfortable topics and keeping others focused on common sense solutions. Leaders such as yourself is where the real change is going to occur. Threat assessment teams are extremely effective. I've seen them and how they work firsthand many times. I believe strongly that many acts of violence that have occurred in our schools over the years could have been prevented if this valuable resource had been in place. Many active shooters could have been stopped. Many children who chose to harm themselves or end their lives could have been prevented. Many children involved in abuse in their personal lives could have been helped earlier, and children who were involved in bullying could have had earlier intervention if this team was in place. The threat assessment team concept is not new to educational institutions. Many colleges and universities across the United States have them in place. Unfortunately, this isn't the case for K-12. I'm asking you to be the catalyst for change and be the voice for kids who want to learn in a safe and secure environment. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gable. Appreciate your testimony. We've got a couple of other testifiers, I think.
Hello, my name is Dr. Christine Keeneland. I'm a forensic psychologist, and I have a threat management consultation business. And I recognize some faces here today, so bear with me if I repeat myself. I thought there'd be all new people today. At any rate, I consult primarily with colleges and companies, but I have consulted with a few high schools. And I want to tell you the story that I experienced. I'm a mother, and of course, safe schools are very, very important to me. I have two daughters in Minneapolis schools. And one day, I dropped my daughter off at elementary school, and I sat in my car outside the school because I got a call from one of the colleges I consult with, and they were calling about a student who had posted a Snapchat message about shooting, and they thought there was a risk to the school. And while I was sitting outside the school was being evacuated, and so, of course, what's on my mind? And then I eventually realized that it was a drill, and my heart stopped racing. But as I drove away, I did think, you know, once the school shooting has started and the school is on lockdown and the kids are being evacuated, it's too late. There are deaths and injuries and hundreds of people traumatized. So what we really need is an early intervention approach, and that is what threat assessment is about. The people who testified earlier did a great job going over how the threat management process works. But I want to talk a little bit more about my experience actually training college threat assessment teams and working in this field. First of all, consider that not only students but also all employees should have a safe working environment. And there are actually national standards for workplace violence prevention by ASIS and SHRM, so national security and HR organizations, and they do recommend threat assessment teams. So ideally, colleges or schools have two teams in place, one focusing on threats involving students and one focusing on threats involving staff. And there's usually some overlap between, you know, the team members. So, for example, the school resource officer would probably be on both teams, or the school principal or administrator. The threats can be internal, so from students or staff or someone involved with the school community. It could be an external threat. So imagine if an employee has a restraining order, they were in an abusive relationship, and then the violence could spill into the workplace, to the schools. Or the same thing could happen with children. Sometimes the person making threats is a former student or someone who knows someone in the school. It could be someone with no relationship at all to the school who's making threats. All threats are concerning and need to be taken seriously. One of the big tasks for the threat assessment team is to build awareness across the school community that threats of violence are not tolerated, violent behavior in the school are not tolerated. You know, we value a culture of safety, and it is safe to report concerns of violence. So you want to make sure that that message, see something, say something, goes to everyone, and that they know how to make reports. There is a process in place. The U.S. Secret Service and the U.S. Department of Education studied school shooters from 1974 to 2000, and one of the important findings was 81% of those school shooters actually gave some hint that they would act out violently. So there was a third party, someone who was aware this person could become a school shooter. And that's why it's so important that people are comfortable reporting concerns. Sometimes it's comments they make about, you know, warning friends or giving some kind of signal, maybe you shouldn't come to school. Sometimes it's postings on social media, but there are signs. And, you know, just consider that when we pay attention to those signals, then we can intervene early and prevent the violence and provide help and support to the person who's engaging in these concerning behaviors. The threat assessment team works like the others who testified mentioned. They work to investigate situations thoroughly and connect the dots. That is the beauty of the threat assessment process. It's a central place where reports of concerns are analyzed and things are less likely to be missed. When we think of the threat assessment approach, it's less focused on actual verbal threats, the words that are spoken, and more focused on behaviors that may pose a threat of violence. You know, since the Florida shooting happened, you've probably heard some news stories about schools that had to respond to some kind of concerning behavior by a student. Maybe it was a copycat behavior, or maybe just even talking about the shooting and that concerned others. There's quite a range in the kinds of reports that will come to the attention of the team. Most people do not make direct threats, and so we do have to pay attention to indirect threats or comments that are concerning. However, we also have to consider that people who say things that are concerning have lots of different reasons. Maybe they're angry, they're fearful, maybe they're trying to be funny, making a joke. And so the threat assessment team is trained to really consider what's behind the concerning comments and behaviors. What everyone is really trying to figure out is there really any violent intent behind the concerning behaviors? So does this person intend to act out violently, or have they taken steps to act out violently, like acquired firearms, for example? It's important to consider that the threat assessment process does not profile. If you engage in profiling in lots of areas of violence, there's a risk of false positives. So concluding that someone is at risk of being someone who would engage in serious violence, then that is really not the case. And when you profile, then there's also the risk of missing the people who are concerning and who could be violent. There are concerns that the threat assessment process could discriminate against students or employees. There is a study that was done in Virginia by Dewey Cornell and others, and I'm not sure if it's been published yet. I have an unpublished version. But in 2013, Virginia became the first state to mandate threat assessment teams in all public schools, and the study examined disciplinary consequences for 1,836 students who received a threat assessment in 779 Virginia elementary, middle, and high schools during the 2014 to 2015 school year. And this statistic showed that there were no disparities among Black, Hispanic, and white students in out-of-school suspensions, school transfers, or legal actions. The most consistent predictors of disciplinary consequences were if the student had a weapon, actually had possession of a weapon, and the team classification of the threat as serious. Some of the more concerning cases are situations where a student is especially fixated on violence, identifies with other people who have engaged in violence, persons who have feelings of anger, resentment, a grudge, and feel like they could be justified in acting out violently, persons who are desperate, you know, they feel like there's no use going on, and they're willing to take their life while engaging in violence towards others, individuals who engage in stalking and domestic violence behavior. That's a very high-risk area. Of course, persons who have taken steps to obtain weapons or actually research on how to carry out an attack, and persons with serious mental health issues. Sometimes it comes in paranoia or psychotic thinking, less often in a K-12 population, fortunately, more often in a college population or in a workplace. So the threat assessment team is considering not only the subject and the potential victim or victims and how that is contributing to the risk, how they respond, but it's also considering the environment and if is anything about the environment that may promote risk, like, for example, a school climate that ignores problems. Now and then we hear about schools in the news where, for example, they ignored serious hazing with even sexual assault. Those incidents need to be addressed and addressed early.
Dr. Keelan, I hate to cut you off, but if you could wrap, I've got two more testifiers, we're getting close to committee time.
Okay. I do want to comment that sometimes the schools need to consult with mental health professionals like me, or maybe it's a mental health center or a hospital. We have the advantage of having the clinical ability to look into the mental health or a disability and how that may contribute to the violence risk. And then we also have the ability to obtain past medical records, mental health records, and so we can contribute a lot to the process that way. So it really is a multidisciplinary team process, and I will end there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. This has been really very enlightening testimony, so I appreciate it, and it's a very deep topic. So Grace Kelleher and Sue Aberholden both had wanted to testify, so if we could hear from both of them quickly, and I do want to allow at least a few minutes for committee questions. So, Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and we've been following iterations of this bill and do feel this is an improvement over the original bill. And I want to tell you that school safety is huge for MSBA. I think I've been at this table not less than 10 times talking about school safety and the importance of that going forward. But I want to alert you to a couple items. Some of the pieces described here about access to a student's record, their social media, any of that, under the Student Data Practices Act, which is included in Chair Erickson's bill, would not allow us to do that. So there's a limitation already moving through that would give us a hard time. We are concerned about age appropriateness, and that's not mentioned in this. We're concerned of the lack of special education pieces in here when 13.8% of our children are special ed and have different accommodations and different requirements. Our attorneys wanted us to mention that it mandates an establishment of a threat team in every building and must include individuals with expertise in counseling, mental health, K-12 instruction, school administration, and law enforcement. Not every school building will have the professionals with expertise in these areas, and they would require us to obtain independent contractors or have a threat assessment team serve multiple buildings, which could negatively affect the provision of other services. Our attorneys also brought our attention to that data on 1.16 or 1.19 related to a student's threatening or abhorrent behavior is classified as private educational data under Minnesota Statute 13.32 and corresponding federal law. This prohibits a school district from sharing information with law enforcement whose jurisdiction includes the area within the school district. Lastly, my attorneys also advised us that there is the requirement of a school threat assessment team would undoubtedly place schools in the arguable position of guaranteeing school safety, thereby exposing it to extreme liability should a student avoid detection or is incorrectly deemed to not be a threat to others. Lastly, Madam Chairman, I want to remind you we have a crisis management policy and we have crisis management teams in our school district. That comes under Minnesota Statute 121A.035, and it mandates that we must adopt those and keep them current. They are originally put together by the Minnesota Department of Education, the Division of Compliance and Assistance, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the School Boards Association. So with that, Madam Chairman, I would pause and answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Let's hear from Ms. Aberholden, and then we are going to go a couple minutes over because I do want to allow for questions. Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Aberholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I just want to raise the issue is we do not want to include suicidal behaviors as part of the threat assessment team. It is a healthcare issue and not a violence issue. There are many districts across the state that are already working with the Minnesota Department of Health to have adopt model policies related to suicide in the schools, including if a suicide does happen, how do you talk about it and things like that. When we look at other states do not require the teachers to have training on suicide prevention. Other states actually do not have school-linked mental health services, and other states do not have mobile mental health crisis teams. So I would really kind of urge you to think about, and I've been working on some language to separate out harm to others and harm to self, because it really should be felt differently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Armaholden. All right, a lot of material. Representative Dabney, you, I think, had raised your hand, so let's see if we can cover a few questions here in a couple minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at this point, I think I've got one question.
Okay.
I appreciate the effort here. Lots to digest, as you indicated. I also appreciate the comments from Ms. Kelleher and Ms. Abderholden. I think there's part of a lot to digest as well. But this does, we've had a number of good hearings on school safety, but it does bring forward the question of the path forwards for school safety here under your leadership, Madam Chair. The governor has made it very clear that he is looking for a clean bill, not one encumbered with other issues. I think this is an area of broad bipartisan support and interest, and would like to work on it in that spirit, but I'm not sure what your path intent is on school safety. Can we anticipate a clean bill on school safety?
I don't really have a response to that yet, Representative Dabney. I think, you know, our original plan was to just have it be part of our supplemental, mm-hmm. Which we are awaiting a target for. I did, you know, the commissioner did reference a letter sent by the governor. I have not received that letter, so I don't know if that was just to leadership or hasn't filtered down to this committee chair yet. So I think those are discussions I'll need to have with our leaders and what their desire may be or directive may be to committees on that topic.
Thank you for that. I think Minnesota expects us to confront their fears and their concerns directly and not have those mixed up with any number of other benign and controversial policy issues. I would hope that we could meet Minnesota's expectations. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the comment. Other questions or comments? Representative Erickson, before we go to you, I had just one quick question for the sergeant. You quoted a figure, and I wasn't quick enough to write it down, but the state of Virginia had mandated threat assessment teams for their schools, and you said there was some money provided for training and that for that purpose, but I don't remember what the amount was that you said.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it was $700,000. In my understanding, I spoke with their school safety office that implemented the law, did all the training. They contracted with a private company to do the guidelines and policies, and it was $700,000 over 3 years.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, we did not receive separate bills from the governor regarding school safety. The policy was embedded in the policy bill, and I believe the other expenditures are embedded in the bill that they brought to finance. So might be a conflict there with what the governor is saying. But my question to the testifier is, so Sergeant, considering what you heard from School Boards Association and from NAMI, our Organization on Mental Health, how do you respond to some of their concerns in how we would couch a threat assessment if that goes forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sergeant.
Yeah, Representative Erickson. One of the issues they had concerns about specifically the federal law around FERPA and HIPAA. Actually, the U.S. Department of Education has dealt at length with this. They've issued Dear Colleague letters supporting threat assessment teams in K-12. So it is not a violation of FERPA laws to have multidisciplinary threat assessment teams. It's so important to have multidisciplinary because you have different expertise, obviously, but you also have access to different kinds of information. So one of the reasons that all the experts, including Department of Education, suggest you have to have law enforcement, like your school resource officer, on the team is because your SRO can do social media research that maybe your teachers can't. and then everybody brings their discussions to the team meeting. So, and FERPA specifically allows SROs, for instance, to be on your team with a certain designation from the school district. So that's one issue. In regards to, there is a debate, I think, among professionals about including just suicidal individuals versus, you know, risk of homicide or threats to others. I think what we've seen, or what the research shows, is that they're not always separate, and probably Dr. Keeneland can address this, but one study from the early 2000s found that virtually every school shooter was significantly depressed and or suicidal. So it's certainly a robust discussion right now, I think, in certain circles. But
I would just comment that most suicidal students or employees are not going to come to the attention of the threat assessment team because they're not threatening other people. They're not engaging in threatening behaviors towards others. It's when you have both that is absolutely appropriate for the threat assessment team because they could take their lives and take the lives of others.
Representative Moran, you have
a question. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just wondering, I think someone mentioned that there had been like a case in Virginia, there has been 1,000 or so maybe threat assessments that had came forward. I was just wondering from that, or however the language was, how many of those proved to be a threat?
I have that same study. It's unpublished yet. I don't know how many they deemed to be a threat. The major finding from that research was that by having a formal program where people are trained, it reduces the overreaction that's natural for schools when they have a threatening situation. And so they actually found that fewer of these incidents were actually threatening or presented serious concern. I don't have the exact number because I haven't had a chance to go through the whole study yet. But.
Madam Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I just have to share that I have a lot of tension here when I hear this, right? And many of my concerns are the concerns of Mrs. Kelleher and Dr. Hoban. It's just like red flags all over the place for me. And from the report, biases and although I hear you state in your report that there was no racial profiling or no profiling, I just get a lot of tension from that. I just really do. And the impact that has on that student because of the behavior that may be dimmed that pulls them out into a conversation, And so I do have a lot of attention about this type of process. Believing that safety is a priority for everyone, right? But we do it in a thoughtful, considerate way that doesn't give a feel for, a military law enforcement type of initiative. So, when you talk about red flag behaviors and things like that, I'm really uncomfortable about all the mandates, too. The must, every school must have it. I think it really takes away from each individual school plan about what they see needs to be done instead of this huge must establish a committee with oversight. I mean, that's a lot of hiring of people to do things within each individual school district. So I really feel very uncomfortable about this mandate that all school has to do it in this particular way, and it must be this oversight, and it must include this. And, each school is different, have different funding, have different procedures in place about what it is that they want to do.
All right, and I'm going to allow Representative Frankie to respond, and then we really have to leave because higher ed has to be in this room in 6 minutes. So, Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Chair Lewin. Representative Moran, I guess some of your questions I will respond that as far as the disparities testimony and the approachability of the different sex, she. In our previous committee, when we were in Chair Erickson's, some of those questions had come forward. So the testifiers tried to address some of those previous questions in their testimony by bringing forward that information. I guess I've tried to give a lot of latitude with this for the schools. One thing I don't want to do is put an unfunded mandate into our school systems. We also addressed a lot of the concerns around the data sharing. We have restricted it just to educational data versus other data, which actually will make it a little bit harder on the assessment teams, I believe, personally, but also allowing it to be just district-wide and not saying that you must set these certain parameter policies. I also want them to be able to adjust their policy, and some of that will be coming down the pipeline before hopefully we get it included into the omnibus bill. But I want to do my best to allow as much flexibility as possible for our school districts. I believe that an ounce of prevention in a situation like this, if for me personally, I guess as a father and a grandfather, if somebody pulls my kid aside, regardless of the behavior they're exhibiting, and it's a negative or possibly a life-changing behavior, I want somebody to tell me. I want somebody to reach out to my kid. I don't see this as a police state. I don't see this as a militarization of our school districts. I see this as putting more opportunities and people in places to give our kids the help that they need. And I hope that all of you can see that too. You know, with some of the other stuff that we're hopefully putting out there, the funding and the availabilities for the hiring of more people within our schools, I think that this could be just one added piece of a puzzle. It's a proven method of keeping, you know, our schools safe. Most of our higher education institutions have already done this or are already getting it done throughout our state, throughout the entire United States. Several states have already made a statewide initiative, and I'm more than willing to work with the schools. Last thing I want to do is hamstring our already overburdened school districts, but I also want to have the policies in place to give them the resources that they need, not only to stay safe, but to have a hand there to reach out to our kids when they need help.
All right, and that'll have to be the final word. Again, thank you very much to our testifiers. I'm sorry we didn't have much more time for discussion. The bill is laid over, and committee is adjourned.